All righty. Good afternoon, everybody. Sam Molyneux from Free Domain. And I hope you're doing well. And I am, of course, happy to take your questions. I put out a tweet. Oh, is it this morning? Yes, 9:21 a.m. Put out a wee tweet. And I wrote, peak female sexual beauty evolved to last from maybe 6 to 12 months, just enough time to find a husband and start having babies. Now single women are trying to stretch that out into their 40s and even 50s, and society dares to talk about men who don't grow up. Right. Right. And, you know, it's a wild thing. I suppose I feel sometimes like the last lonely man on social media who grew up reading actual books. You know, I mean, I'm old enough that, I mean, we had like no TV and I lived at the library. I mean, I just go and read books, and it didn't really even matter to me what the topic was. You know, I hated being home. The library was quiet and peaceful. There were great books, comfortable chairs, get your water, go to the bathroom. And I just live in the library. And I just read and read and read. Now, then, of course, I started writing short stories when I was 6 years old. I wrote my first novel, or at least half a first novel, when I was 11. And I've written, I don't know, like 25 plays, hundreds of poems, I don't know, 8 or 9 major novels. And so, I studied English literature at York University right here in Canada. And of course, they were old school, right? So when I studied English literature, you have to read really carefully. You have to read really carefully, make sure you understand something, particularly if you're triggered. Right? That's just a sort of discipline thing that I was used to, which is if something upsets you, read it really carefully to make sure you've got it right. There was a pretty bad sitcom, but it had its funny moments when I was a kid, called Three's Company. And it became a joke among my sort of friends that it was bad because everything was about a misunderstanding. Everything was about a misunderstanding. So somebody's talking about the size of shoes in the next room, and it sounds like they're talking about penis size, right? So it's cheap jokes, and there's nothing wrong with cheap jokes. Lord knows I've made my share over the years, so I'm not sort of complaining about that. But it was all about misunderstandings, and I guess the lesson was kind of like, well, if you don't listen carefully, if you jump to conclusions, you know, bad things are going to happen in your life. So I'm just used to reading carefully, and particularly if something upsets me, I'll read it 3 times to make sure that I understand it. I mean, if you get a message from your wife saying, and she says, I'm going to affair, and you think, oh my God, she's going to go have an affair, and you call the lawyer and you start divorce proceedings and you cut her off and you block her, and it's like, no, she's just going to the summer fair. She wants to pick up some butter tarts or something, right? So jumping to conclusions is a challenge. So it's wild, man. So I wrote, peak female sexual beauty evolved to last for maybe 6 to 12 months. Now, why do I say 6 to 12 months? Because I've read my Victorian novels. In fact, I took an entire course called The Rise of the Novel when I was taking my, I didn't finish my English degree. I went to theater school and then I finished my undergraduate in history. In part because English was too subjective. Like I was reading something on X, a guy said that he wrote a poem, and then later he was taking a test and they said, explain the meaning of this poem. And it was his poem. He knew what the meaning was. And he wrote the meaning down of the poem that he wrote without saying that he wrote it. And they marked him as he fails. He didn't get the meaning of the poem. Like the guy who wrote the poem is telling you what the poem's about, but he got failed for that. It's too subjective for me. And I moved to history back when I thought that history wasn't also rapidly subjective. But anyway, so I took this whole course on the rise of the novel. And through that process, it started in the 18th century. Daniel Defoe and others were writing, you know, Pamela a little bit later, and, you know, just the really sort of early Moll Flanders, the early novels. And certainly there was a pretty short courtship period. There had to be, because people were getting snatched up into permanent marriages. So if you're 18, 19 years old, and let's say you're a young woman, and you have to figure out who you're going to marry, and you have to figure it out pretty quickly. It's an auction, right? It's an auction where everything's being auctioned off at the same time and the good stuff is going quickly. So you have to, so sort of nature programmed peak female sexual beauty evolved to last for maybe 6 to 12 months, right? So you hit your beauty as an adult, you're 18, you're 19, 6 to 12 months, you're married. Like, boom. And it's probably not even, I'm actually saying it could take up to a year. Most courtships were very short, a couple of months max. And I mean, I did this in my Truth About the Wild West presentation, which you can find at fdrpodcast.com. I was talking about how I think it was a third of marriages in the Wild West were shotgun weddings. And they can tell that, of course, from the date of the wedding and then the date of the birth. So, you know, people got knocked up. They got married pretty quickly. There was a pretty short courtship period. So peak female sexual beauty evolved. And we'll just go with 6 to 12 months. It's a generous estimate. Why? So you could, you know, moth to a flame. You could attract a man with peak sexual beauty. And then you start having kids. And you have a whole succession of kids. Because remember, half the kids died before the age of 5. So you just have a whole bunch of kids. And I was writing about this in my early 20s. I wrote a book called Just Poor, which you should really check out. It's a fantastic book, if I do say so myself. It's a novel set in the 1700s in England. And I write about a young woman who's very beautiful. And then the obsessive demands of work and babies scraped that beauty off like an obsessive painter, constantly dissatisfied with what he does, right? Scrape it off. So I've known all about this stuff for, gosh, I mean, close to 40 years now. And yeah, that historically, that's the way it went. You got your peak female beauty, and it was magnificent. I mean, young women and young men are beautiful. You know, if you see, particularly with high def now, like you see a young person's face next to their mother's face, and you didn't notice this so much when it was like heavily Vaseline-lensed, squinto vision, Olivia de Havilland-style stuff from the past. But now with high def and 4K, man, it's like looking at a balloon versus the moon as far as cragginess and all of that goes. And I'm no different. I did a video. I haven't released it yet. I did a video. I think it was yesterday or the day before outside. And I'm squinting into the sun. I'm like, oh, welcome, Crypt Keeper. Because, you know, I'm pushing 60, right? So I'm getting craggy. I'm getting mighty craggy. I'm relatively youthful until I smile. And then it's like, oh, welcome to death's door. And that's just the way that it is. I was a pretty good looking young guy. Got scouted for modeling and all kinds of stuff. And it doesn't last though, right? So peak female sexual beauty evolved to last for maybe 6 to 12 months, just enough time to find a husband and start having babies. There's nothing wrong with that historically. Now, what do people say, right? Well, Christoph wrote, Botox is one particularly demonic trade-off. Studies have now shown that it breaks your empathy by preventing you from showing your own emotions or mirroring others. Because they did a picture of a woman who went through some cosmetic procedures. And I actually replied, like, can you imagine? Imagine what it's like for a baby if your mother has Botox and she can't mirror your expressions. I mean, that's going to be brutal. A woman wrote, I honestly thought this was common knowledge. I knew my window was short and stacked the best quality mate at a young age. Do women actually think they'll be hot forever? What? Right. And Syned wrote, what? Is this just another poor attempt from older men past their prime trying to justify lusting after 18-year-olds? Because it's getting old. And it's like, it's so funny, you know? Am I past my prime physically? Yes, right? I actually thought it was younger than it was. I thought it was in late teens for men, but actually it's sort of 25 to 30. Seems to be peak, you know, strength and cardio for men. But, you know, I'm like decades past that, right? So I don't know. I don't know why. Why is this hard to admit? Am I as good looking now, 58, as I was when I was 18? Like, of course not. Am I as limber? Am I as strong? Do I have the same endurance? No. I mean, I try to work out. I mean, I do work out. I sort of try. But of course, I'm way past my prime. Intellectually, I think I'm better than ever, personally. But, you know, that's not for me to decide, perhaps. So this woman, I think it's a woman. She writes, 6 to 12 months, you should elaborate if the logic behind that even I already know you are one of those intelligent, narcissistic, sexist pricks. It's pretty funny, you know, to like verbally abuse someone or lacerate them or insult them and then say, oh, listen, could you elaborate that for me? That's pretty funny, man. It's pretty funny. Now, the misreading, and again, just learn to read carefully. It's really, really important. I mean, it'll save your life. It'll save your marriage. It'll save your friendships. It'll say, like, learn to read carefully. Don't go off half-cocked. Be like me. Only ever go off fully cocked. So peak female sexual beauty evolved to last for maybe 6 to 12 months. Right. So from the time you're on the dating market, for the aristocrats, that would be maybe your debutante ball, or from the time you're really on the dating market until you get married and start having kids, well, then it's different, right? You get kids, your body stretches out, and there's some people who bounce back, but that's a huge amount of work. So yeah, it evolved to last. Now, when I say peak female sexual beauty evolved to last for maybe 6 to 12 months, which is your courtship until you start having babies, I'm not saying that women are only attractive for 6 to 12 months, right? Peak is not the whole mountain, right? If you're climbing up Everest, you get to the peak and then you start climbing down. You're still way above sea level. You're still super above sea level. You're just not at the peak, right? So the peak is not the only thing. It's not binary. It's a bell curve, so to speak, right? So when I say it evolved to last for maybe 6 to 12 months, that's what it's evolved for. That doesn't mean that you can't be attractive later on in life. Of course you can, right? But peak, right? Peak. Let's see here. I find these things kind of interesting. I don't think nature cares if a woman gets married. That's a human-created thing based on our history. It was likely developed by men and probably for good reasons. Well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because a woman's peak sexual beauty diminishes when she's pregnant for other men, for obvious, unless you've got some weird kink, right? For obvious evolutionary reasons, right? And the obvious evolutionary reasons is men don't want to invest resources into raising other men's kids, right? Evolutionarily speaking, that didn't work. So it doesn't matter. And what, there was a couple of other things. Oh yeah, so Gertrude writes, 6 to 12 months? Really? Why not say 30 minutes? It sure doesn't seem like it in real life to me. I'd say 4 to 5 years seems more likely, but it's still a good point. And it's a fantastic facelift, by the way. So again, I'm not saying that women are only attractive for 6 to 12 months. I'm saying that our peak attractiveness evolved to get a husband and then start having babies because people have huge amounts of lust and there's no birth control. So you're just going to have babies and the babies are going to take away your attractiveness, particularly in history, right? When there wasn't Pilates and gyms and all that kind of stuff, right? And Jackson writes, 6 to 12 months to find a husband? Harsh. 9 years seems more reasonable than realistic. 80 to 27 years of age. Now! So, like, the word evolution does not mean 5 minutes ago. Like, what is people's life and time span when it comes to viewing language? Evolution is way back beyond human history. Like, human history, written history, 5,000-10,000 years old, whatever, 5,000 years old, probably closer, if you don't count cave paintings or whatever, right? So I'm talking like hundreds of thousands or millions of years, right? 6 to 12 months. Women's window is short, but not that short. Well, again, I don't know why people have difficulty thinking about the past. I'm not talking about. And then Amy writes, wait, what? 6 months? So she's hot at 18 and by 18.5, she's old and decrepit? That's a typo, right? What the fuck? Oh my gosh. Oh, that's funny. So if a man's peak, let's say, is 27 years old, his physical peak is 27 years old, that doesn't mean he's a decrepit old man at 27.5. It just means that's his peak. Anyway, it's wild. Again, I feel sad, like in a way, like in all seriousness, because this is the result of government schools congenitally unable to teach people how to think. And can you imagine being in a relationship with someone where you say something and they just explode because they've misunderstood what you say? Like, this is, it's not about X, it's not about Twitter, it's not about my little account, it's not, this is a life lesson. This is why I'm spending some time on this, a life lesson. Please, for the love of all that's holy, do not jump to conclusions and then rush to judgment and rush to type and all of that kind of stuff. Dear, oh dear. If somebody says, I doubt that, seeing how it takes 9 months to bear a child and a couple only bearing one child would create a population decline. And why didn't you say the actual years? Because it's different in different cultures, right? I don't know. I also like how people think it's a brilliant contribution to the debate. Like, somebody was telling me, hey, Steph, you should really read some Nietzsche. I'm like, oh, really? I've studied philosophy for 40 years. Who's this Nietzsche fella? Is he Scottish? And then people were talking about, well, they talk about Pierce Brosnan's wife. Well, he's Catholic, right? So he's better for worse. And you don't know what health issues people are dealing with if they get heavy. Jennifer Love Hewitt recently showed up looking, a little plump. And she's middle-aged. She's had a bunch of kids. And then what happens is people get triggered when they see a woman who's gained weight, right? And or if they see someone like Pamela Anderson who shows up with makeup. The reason why, like Jamal Warner, the Cosby actor, drowned, I think, this morning, and he's in his 50s, right? So people don't like the passage of time stuff. And I think that's a really unconscious thing, right? People don't like the passage of time stuff. You know, when you hear like Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey and Sting, and, you know, they all have hearing issues because, like, you know, they're, you know, kind of old and decrepit, right? And, you know, I'm not putting myself outside of those categories. I'm just saying that when people like Jennifer Love Hewitt, you remember what she was like when she was young and slender and hot. And now she's like middle-aged, a little plump. She's had kids. I mean, there's nothing particularly wrong with that. I have a particular loathing for gaining weight. I gained some weight, I don't know, about 20 years ago. And I'm down about 40 pounds from my peak. And I mean, that's just my particular horror. And there's nothing particularly special about that. It's just, I try to avoid that as much as possible, in part because I want to spend as much time as possible with my wife and daughter. And also, as an older parent, I really can't let myself go because, you know, I want to be able to play with my daughter, run with my daughter, roughhouse with my daughter when she was younger. And I just have to sort of be responsible that way. Plus, I do feel that I have a pretty good brain for communicating important stuff, and I want to keep that around as long as possible. So I feel a little bit of sort of responsibility. But yeah, so so Jennifer Love Hewitt, what happens is they look and they say, oh, wow, she's gained a lot of weight or whatever it is, right? And then it's the passage of time stuff. You know, if you're comfortable with what you've done with your life, you don't really mind the passage of time. Honestly, I do not mind getting older. I'm very satisfied with what I've done with my life. You know, I started with a very harsh and downtrodden beginning, and I've tried a lot of different things. You know, I did art, I did academics, I did business, I've done philosophy, podcasting, live speeches, tours, like you name it, right? And written a bunch of books, and I've done, you know, I've been a husband, I've been a father, I started businesses, and I think I've done pretty well with what it is that I was given. So I don't mind getting older. I mean, I might mind it when I'm 80, you know, and, you know, things, I'm slowing down a little bit. There's no question of that, you know. My wife and I were just joking the other day, like, we didn't used to make these sounds when we got out of the car after a long drive. Now it's like, oh. Actually, that's either me making that sound from my throat or my back making it on my knees or something like that. But, you know, we can still play an hour of pickleball. So it's, you know, it's not bad as yet. But I think if you're relatively satisfied with what you've achieved in your life, then you see these time flashes, like Jennifer Love Hewitt is now overweight. And I think you're, you know, okay with it. Yeah, she's had her kids, she had a career. I'm sure she still has some kind of career now. And she's done her thing. And if you're comfortable with what you've done with your life, the passage of time, I don't think is quite as bad. So, let's see. Men taking little blue pills, and yet they complain about women's plastic surgery. Laughable. A bunch of old men with their balls down to their knees thinking they are young with a little blue pill. That's kind of like a go-to thing. And of course, do you know the vast majority of men don't have erectile dysfunction into old age? A lot of times it's health issues. And I think we can have some sympathy for that, can't we? I think we can have some sympathy for men who have health issues but still want to have a sexual relations with their wives. It doesn't seem. But anyway, it's just this sort of sad counterattack that goes on. You meant 6 to 12 years after 18 years old. Well, yeah. So these days, if a woman stays single, takes care of herself, or at least doesn't have kids, yeah, she could be attractive for sure. For sure, she could be attractive into her 30s and beyond. And very attractive, right? I mean, my wife's a year younger than I am. She looks great to me. Great. But neither of us would say we look as great as when we were 20. Of course, right? So Krabby writes, who cares about prime? A woman can be beautiful all through her life. No, she can't. No, she can't. I mean, beautiful spiritually, yeah, of course. When we lose our looks, we gain in virtues. And since love is fundamentally a recognition and reciprocation of virtue, when we get older and we lose our looks, but we gain our virtues, we can end up more in love. And that's a beautiful thing. But no, an 80-year-old woman is not beautiful. An 80-year-old man is not beautiful. It's not complicated. Like, you don't see them in modeling ads. You just don't. And there's no Botox for eggs, right? And similarly, there's no little blue pill for sperm, right? Man's sperm ages. Women's eggs die off by the time she's 40-ish. And a man's sperm deteriorates in quality as he ages, and so on, right? So no, it's just not being able to read carefully. The woman writes, it's not our fault you're disgusted by us after 25. So I didn't say that at all. Didn't say that at all. So it's a good lesson for people, I think, as a whole. Don't jump to conclusions. Read carefully. Listen carefully. And I suppose as a whole, don't assume the worst in people. I think that's sort of an important principle in life as a whole. Like just don't automatically assume the worst in people. Now, I'm obviously can be pretty harsh back when it comes to people attacking me online. Yeah, I mean, I'm an attack back kind of guy. I mean, verbally, right? Because I believe in self-defense. I morally justified it and all of that. So yeah, it's a sad thing. And I do think, of course, and the last thing I mentioned, of course, I'd love to hear from you guys too about this, or, you know, whatever topic is on your mind. But the last thing that I'll mention is that, you know, be really careful with people who have a lot of regret in their life. Be careful with people who've made bad decisions and have a lot of regret in their life. They will be very triggered by the passage of time. When I see people who are middle-aged getting triggered by the passage of time, which is looking at Jennifer Love Hewitt or me talking about peak attractiveness is when you're young. Oof, you know, people who have regret, and particularly the people who have the regret of inaction, right? So there's two things we regret. I know it's kind of a binary, right? We regret the things that we do, and we also regret the things that we don't do. And the people who regret the things they haven't done. And when you're young, you fear things that you're going to do. And when you're older, you regret the things you didn't do. And I always, when I was younger, I was like, I got accepted to the National Theatre School in Canada. And I went because I didn't want to sit there and say, gee, I could have been a big playwright or actor or something like that. And they only take like 1 out of 1,000 people, right? So 1 out of 1,600, sorry, 1 out of 100 people. So take 1%. And so I, you know, wanted to go and wanted to give it a try. It turned out that I don't like the theater world. And the theater world doesn't really like me as a sort of free market capitalist guy, because they're a bunch of state-sucking socialist toadies for the most part. So if you're around people who have wasted time, and listen, time well wasted is not a bad phrase. There's times like, you know, yesterday I was reading a book after I did quite a bit of work during the day, and I'd like doze for like 20 minutes in the sunshine. It's really nice, you know. Time well wasted. And there's nothing wrong with wasting some time, because we can't be productivity machines always. It's like working out 24 hours. You just get injured, right? So, but the people who've wasted too much time and haven't really achieved their potential, well, that's rough, man. They will be triggered by the passage of time. And since the passage of time is inevitable, they will be forever triggered. And they will pull you down, man. All right, so let's get to the real brains of the outfit, which is not my rambling chatterhead, but you glorious listeners. S. Lewis. I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis. Maybe that's your shuffleboard acronym. If you want to unmute, I'm all ears, my friend. Come on, man. Don't make me edit stuff. I'm lazy.
Oh, hey, brother. I didn't see you. I had a phone call.
Yep.
Sorry about that. Got distracted with business. So where are we at in this conversation? We're still talking about female beauty and male beauty and age and fertility, are we not?
This is the call-in part, so we are talking about what you want to talk about.
I think we just have got extremely strange social dynamics now, very unnatural ones. And I'm still trying to figure out how do we tell young men to navigate the distorted mating market? Like, it's a very artificial mating market when you look at it historically. Never have people in human history had such a broad range of selection as they do today. Like, before, you might have dated the people in your little village, and maybe it was 500 people, you know, so you couldn't chase, you know, Chads and Beckys. But now with the internet, the entire world is your dating app. You know what I mean? The whole world is your dating pool now. And it especially favors women, who are always sought after. You know, women have the thing that men want. So women have the supply and men have all the demand. So I don't know how we put the wheels back on the bus. I've thought about it a lot. I mean,
well, I think the biggest distortion in the dating market is the subsidization of sexual access for female dating. That was expressly forbidden throughout, I mean, just about all of recorded history in most relatively advanced cultures, that you were simply not allowed to subsidize your sexual market value with sexual access. You had to get married. Sorry, go ahead.
Just to clarify, you're speaking about social welfare systems in this regard?
No, I mean, it just the general, I mean, that's certainly part of it, but just the general acceptance that women can go and sleep with a bunch of guys and they then don't know if the guys like them. And this makes women crazy, right?
Yeah.
It makes women crazy. And so women, it's real torture for women. And I, you know, I certainly have some sympathy. I have some judgment and blame, but I certainly have some sympathy, which is if the other girls are putting out and if you don't put out, you're probably not going to get dates. It's the same thing with like, if all the girls are showing a lot of flesh and you don't show a lot of flesh, you may not get male attention, right? So there used to be this kind of cabal of women who were like, okay, we're not going to give sexual access without marriage, or at least some engagement or some serious commitment that's going to have follow through and so on. And so for women, women want love, like we all do. Women want love. They want loyalty. They want devotion. And if you hurl sex at a man, particularly a young man who is, you know, high in hormones and low in judgment, then he's going to have sex with you. And as a woman, you then get male attention. But because you throw sex at the man, you don't know if he's there for the sex or for you, right? Everybody wants to be loved for who they are. And the only people loved for who they are babies. Everybody wants to be loved for who they are. And for women, there's this torture in that they can get men into their lives, but the same mechanism that they use to get men into their lives a lot, which is sexual access, has them feeling that he's just there for sex. They resent, they dislike, they and this is why a lot of high sex relationships, like the love bomb in the first couple of months, turns into this arid sexual desert later on, because there's too much resentment and there's too much falsehood, right? Because the man usually has to lie and say, oh no, it's not the sex I'm here for. It's your deep spiritual essence and all that. It's all usually a bunch of nonsense. So I think it's real torture for women. They have almost infinite choice and they have this bizarre subsidy that is absolutely ahistorical in that they can have consequence and complications, so to speak, free sex, which so subsidize. So it's like the kid who inherits, you know, $10 million. I mean, he wants to be thought of as a great businessman, but the $10 million thing will always be kind of hanging over his early career. It's way too much subsidy to be sure if you're good at anything, if that makes sense.
No, I totally get your point. And I mean, if we look back historically, if you look at books like, you know, Hester Pern, where she has to wear the A, why did she have to wear the A? Because all the other women in the village knew that if that behavior was allowed to continue unabated, it would destroy the sexual value of all the women in the village and therefore destroy their ability to secure long-term mates by reducing the cost of sex.
You mean if there was a woman who was an adulteress?
Correct. And that is exactly why she was so roundly publicly denounced. It's like people are like, oh, look how ostracized she were. Yes, that was the entire point. The point was that the social cost of doing that moved you into the out-group. And historically, being in the out-group meant you might have starved to death. Because if you couldn't be a part of the village and you were a woman, that social ostracization was the deterrent. And the fact that we've somehow decided that we're going to undo all that as some sort of net social good, because let's face it, men respond to physical force, right? Like the reason I don't get into more bar fights, despite some disrespectful jackasses really needing a good square punch in the mouth, is because I don't like jail. And the reason that women didn't cheat in the past was because they were socially exiled. And being socially exiled as a woman in pre-modern era, and let's just set that cutoff date for 1900, right? If you had to go work a farm, a piece of dirt by yourself as a single mother, you were probably going to starve to death. There was just no way around it. And so women were socially ostracized to prevent precisely that mate poaching behavior that you're talking about. And we've decided that because we've got all this modernity and all these resources, that that's a good thing. So we should undo all this. And I'm like, are we nuts? Did we not learn anything from the last 2,000 years of history? That the reason these systems evolved was to prevent the types of problems that we're talking about today. I mean,
no, I think that's true. I would add one other I think, fairly important element, and you can certainly let me know what you think. I think a pretty important element is societies don't last when children are raised with uncertain paternity. And so one of the problems with an adulterer was it made paternity uncertain. And when a man is uncertain of his children, like if he's the father of his children, he just invests less resources into them. You know, it's the old statement, it's mama's baby, it's daddy's maybe. And so to maximize male investment into their children, which is the only way society can sustain itself, to maximize a father's investment into his child meant that he had to have nearly virtual certainty that it was his child. And so an adulteress, by sleeping with a man she's not married to, is going to produce a child. And if she's sleeping with more than one man, she doesn't have the man. Or if she's only sleeping with one man, he may never know that, but he's not going to be as invested. And so single mothers, by having children without an invested father, are producing, I mean, pretty feral kids a lot of times. And we can sort of understand that, right? So evolutionarily speaking, if there was father absence, that meant that you were growing up in a scarcity-based, violent society, because the men had either, you know, they'd been killed in war, or they had to engage in such dangerous hunting that they got killed or injured on a regular basis, or something, like there was some big problem why the men weren't around. And so it programs the young to grow up with huge amounts of aggression and low restraint, no neofrontal cortex restraint on impulses. So tend to be impulsive. Girls tend to enter into menses earlier. Boys tend to be more violent and aggressive. And that's just nature programming the kids that if the fathers aren't around, you need to be uncivilized, because civilized ain't going to work in a time of war and scarcity. You need to be aggressive. You need to be violent. You need to be hair trigger. You need to, you know, take offense and strike first. And you need to. So when you have kids growing up with uncertain paternity or absent fathers, you are raising an entire coterie, an entire generation, or huge swaths of that generation that don't fit into relatively peaceful, high trust societies. And that's one thing that claws down the sort of historical edifices of civilization pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. No, you can see it. I've done a lot of reading on the Roman civilization, because it's one of the largest, most well-documented civilization failures that we have to really look at, right? I mean, because there aren't like a lot of examples of extremely successful societies imploding quite the way they did. And I do know that I've seen historical accounts, maybe poorly translated, that indicate that there was a rise in single motherhood, a drop in marriage, and an increase in promiscuous behavior with the advent of a lot of state social welfare systems. And it's interesting that the pattern looks almost identical. And so what I'm wondering is, and maybe it's just something that people don't want to talk about because it makes them uncomfortable, does resource availability for women decouple their sense of like long-term mating strategy?
Because there's no question. Yeah, there's no question. There's no question that it does. I mean, men, we have, you know, 40% greater upper body strength, stronger work ethic, stronger skeletal structure, because we are the workhorses for the family, because we have to produce, you know, 10 times what we need for ourselves in order to maintain a family. So we are the workhorses of the world, and the women are the nurturers of the world. But when women can get resources without men, then men become recreational. And when men become recreational, there's just less commitment. I mean, think of, again, we sort of mentioned the guy earlier who inherits $10 million. And so he has a job, but it's kind of recreational. It's not, you know, he doesn't have to have the job for living, or if he gets fired, he's going to go hungry. Like when I've been paying my own bills since I was 15 years old, and I couldn't afford to get fired because like I couldn't pay rent. I couldn't buy food. Like it was very, very serious. And so everything becomes a hobby. The commitment isn't there, right? Now, there's this old country song, "Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman left and took all the reasons I've been working for." So yeah, if he doesn't have to pay for a family, he doesn't really care about the job. Or, you know, there's the old thing, like when Bitcoin pumps, you know, there will be signs and it's some boss saying he wants something, and the employee says, "You shut your dirty mouth." And he can talk back to his boss. So he doesn't have to subjugate himself to work, to ethics, to the requirements of business, to the necessity of an income, because he's got a bunch of income. And, you know, people, they don't, because they think welfare is like this big poverty thing, you know, barely enough to, it's like, that's not true, man. In America, I did a whole show on this many years ago. It's called The Welfare Cliff, which is for a woman with two kids. I'm trying to think of the inflation now. A woman with two kids gets welfare benefits that are so high that she'd have to have a job making well north of $100,000 just to break even. Because if you add up all the benefits that women get, and subsidized housing and SNAP and welfare directly and rent control and all of that. And of course, if her kids are, quote, disabled, you know, they've got some ADHD or whatever, she gets a bunch of supplemental income with regards to that. And I remember many years ago, I was at a park with my daughter, and I was listening to these two women literally discussing how to milk the system. They were these two women, middle of the day, right? And they were like, oh, but if you apply for this program, okay, you'll lose a little bit here, but boy, you get a huge amount out of that. And then if you get this program, you can use it to piggyback onto this program. And they were just going back and forth. Like you could see the Excel spreadsheets whirling around in their calculating brains. And the amount of money that gets poured into single moms is truly staggering. And again, this isn't even counting things like government schools, which are subsidized and they're not paying taxes for those. Free healthcare, which is subsidized, they're not paying taxes for those. So you'd have to make, as a single mother of two, if you start making a little over $100,000 a year, then you're no longer taxed at 100%. And the reason it's called the welfare cliff is that to get out of welfare, you have to get a job. But if you get a job, you lose your benefits and you're effectively being taxed at 100% or sometimes even more than 100% because you lose more benefits than you're making in salary. And then once you start making north of $100,000, your first $100,000 is taxed at 100%, but after that, you can start to make a few pennies on the dollar. It's almost impossible to get out of. And the amount of resources that are being thrown at single mothers with, say, two kids and no dads is more than, you know, all the aristocracy had access to in many ways in many countries, because she has access to all of the modern technologies and all of that. So, you know, would you rather be the king of France in the 15th century, or would you rather be a single mother in the 21st century? I mean, the choice is simple, and it just makes men recreational and optional. But of course, men are not optional for the children, just for the mother.
No, I totally understand that, because, you know, and I can say this from personal experience, is that my dad was murdered when I was a year old. And so my mom went on the system, right? And so all of her friends were single mothers on the system. So believe you me, I am intimately familiar with the growth of the welfare system. And mind you, I'm almost 50, so I grew up with it in the 70s and 80s. And the difference between today's welfare and food assistance and then is just absolutely astounding. Like, we used to line up and go to the food bank, and we would get like a box of milk, and it would say powdered milk, and it would be like beef in a can, and then it's a cheese, and it said cheese. You know, and this is a big, giant box, absolutely ridiculously high-quality cheddar that Reagan was making people get rid of. But and back then, there wasn't rent assistance, and there wasn't all the facilities there are now. And so my take on modern welfare is essentially this. A group of very psychopathic, licentious men have legislated into place a permanent proxy for prostitution so that they can sleep around with women who are stuck in this situation, and it certainly would appear that they vote that way frequently. So there's a class of men in politics who have created a low-quality mating sexual dynamic, maybe even misguidedly, to try and prop up the birth rate, which we know has been a problem since the 80s. I just, honestly, to me, it looks like they're creating a proxy prostitution market, you know?
They call them Guildford farms in the neighborhood, right? The Girlfriend Farms is just a bunch of women. Oh, yeah. And sorry to hear about your dad, by the way. I don't want to sort of let that pass unremarked. But, and it's, you know, the abstractions, you know, I posted the other day, like, what commandments did the West break to fall so hard? And I mean, the foundational one is two, really. Thou shalt not bear false witness. We lie about things all the time. And the second is thou shalt not steal. Charity should be voluntary. All that is compelled, other than direct self-defense, all that is compelled corrupts. And charity needs to be voluntary, because there needs to be a judgment. And maybe it was men who implemented it. Maybe men dangled it before women, but women sure struck at it, a lot of them, and vote for it. And it's a huge issue, right? And then, of course, you have the welfare state that's developed for like the local population that ends up being a giant magnet for people from other countries. And but by then it's, you know, too embedded in the population to even consider changing. And for me, I'm not sure if this is the case with your mom, but my own mother has been on welfare for, I mean, ever and ever. Amen. And, you know, one of the really tragic things about it, outside of the, you know, general abstract moral principles and the negative effects it has on the poor, is I have no say in my mom's life because she's not worked in decades. And if she was, say, dependent upon me, I could have a say. Like, I could say, well, you need to do this, you need to do that, you know, maybe get some therapy, you know, I'd have some sway. She'd have to kind of listen to me in a way. And it's not like I want this big control over her or anything like that, but I have some really good advice that she doesn't have to listen to. She doesn't have to listen to it because she's going to get money from the government. So she doesn't need to change. So she has passed outside of my influence because the government just gives her money and keeps her rent low and gives her free health care and all of that. So she can just go off and make, in my view, you know, very bad mistakes and continue to make very bad mistakes. And I have no say in it because the money is taken from me and given to her without any requirement for making better decisions. So, sorry, go ahead.
No, certainly, certainly. And you know, I don't know, you're in Canada, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I don't know if you follow our politics. I'm assuming you do down here in the States. SNAP is getting a revamp right now, currently, about what they will allow people to purchase on SNAP. And there's a whole lot of people pissing and moaning and crying about it. And personally, my take on it is, and I've had this discussion with my local representative. By the way, my screen name isn't my colleague. It's not even close. So it's a word play on CSLS. I'm sure you figured that out already. But
yeah.
So I happen to like CSLS. So I had a talk with my local representative and I said, you know, I said, look at what we're spending on healthcare, right? Like we can't afford to keep spending on healthcare. In the United States, we're spending, I think if the last I looked, and this is 2021 or 2022 numbers, so, and they're not to the penny, but we're spending nearly $3 trillion a year in federal money. That means we're going out and taking $3 trillion a year from working citizens and putting it into Medicaid and Medicare. And then we're spending it back out. And the bulk of it's actually going out in the Medicaid money for the, not for the elderly, but it's actually going to young people, namely single mothers and children. And so like the 60-70% of that money is being spent on treating metabolic disorders like obesity, asthma. So like there's this huge cluster of illnesses, right? And they can all be found directly correlated to high glucose intake. So it's people eating really low quality nutritional items like, you know, boxed foods, noodles, rice, you know, these low nutrition devoid, high carbohydrate foods are just driving a disease epidemic in this country. And we're subsidizing it. And then on top of that, our SNAP money is going to pay for the exact food that's causing the medical spending. So it's like a double whammy. And so I started doing a little digging. And so here's what turns out to be the case. BlackRock manages a tremendous number of, you know, pension funds for the federal and state governments. And they're heavily invested in the medical industry and the food industry. And so two of the biggest spenders in the medical and the food industry is the federal government, SNAP and Medicaid. And so the pension funds that they manage are directly benefiting from the poor nutrition on both the sales side, the cheap, high profit, low nutrition, high carb foods, and the disease side, where we have kids that are loaded full of diseases, ADHD, neurodevelopmental disorders. And that's before we even account for the ridiculousness of our very untested social experiment we're calling mass vaccination. And I've said,
well, and sorry, just want to mention one other thing too, which
experiment, because it's not well proven. It's not like we have a whole state of kids that's never been vaccinated to AB with. We don't have outside of the Amish, who they will never include in the data. We don't have a good gold standard, you know, nominal group. So it's just the data's not there.
I just wanted to mention as well that they also benefit in that if they're heavily invested in pensions and people, because of these ailments, don't make it to old age, they got a whole lot less pension to pay out. So there's a profit in that too.
Oh yeah, no doubt. And that's what I was trying to get at. Like, you know, the 19 vax having the high side effect rate that it does isn't necessarily bad for actuary tables for life insurance companies and for health insurance companies and for, you know, states paying out like ridiculous pensions. I looked at Michigan's budget 4 or 5 years ago, and over 50%, and it's hard to tell because they, you know, the way they manipulate numbers, over 50% of the state budget is going to pay retired teachers, healthcare, and pay it. And to me, that's just absolutely ridiculous that people are going to be on those benefits for 25, 30 years. Like, why can't someone teach until they're 65? Why do they get to retire at 50? There's nothing about teaching that is so physically demanding that someone can't do it until they're 70. It's absolutely amazing.
No, but I think teaching is becoming progressively more unpleasant as IQ drops and as behavioral problems increase. I think that, you know, the fear that we all had as kids of negative consequences and teachers seems to be kind of evaporating. I mean, and I think also the older teachers are probably, some of them are quite repulsed by the contents of the new curriculum, particularly the highly sexualized stuff that is all just kinds of creepy stuff to talk about with kids. But all right, listen, I got another caller. Really appreciate your call. I'm sorry again about your dad. And I guess keep on raising the awareness of these issues. They sound super important to me.
Have a good one, man.
All right. Autists for autism. What's on your mind? Oh, it is gone. Well, maybe the autist. No, click the wrong button. All right. Questions, comments, issues, challenges. Happy to hear what is on your mind. And don't forget, of course, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Help out the show. Donations gratefully, deeply, and humbly accepted. And remember, this is why we have no ads, no sponsors, nothing to fast forward past. You can listen to me as you doze off, and you don't have to get interrupted by a message from our local sponsor. Also, I don't have to speak super rapidly when it comes to APR financing for these. All right, going once, going twice, my friends. Could have a just little tidy little dip in. Talk about these issues, but yeah, dopamine is a big problem. I think dopamine addiction is a big problem these days. Men get it sometimes from porn. They get it from video games and other things, but I think women get it from male attention, and women wanting male attention is a beautiful thing. It's kind of why we're all here. So that's lovely, but it can definitely last too long. And I think it stretches and stresses women's systems out to get constant bombardments of male attention, and the old phrase sort of sliding into the DMs, right? Constant male attention, constant male lust and thirst, trying to, they call it thirst in the online world. The men are thirsty, like the woman is a tall, cool glass of water. And it's a lot, man. It's a lot of lust. And it's a lot of attention. It's a lot of options. And I think it does fry the dopamine receptors after a while. Like, in a sense, the whole modern world is this massive giant experiment of, okay, just how much stimulation can the human brain conceivably handle? And it's a pretty wild thing to see how much. And but the answer is we don't know yet, but it's not looking good. It's not particularly looking good. The options. So when I was, I guess, younger, I remember maybe once or twice a year, and I always remember it was on ITV, once or twice a year, they would play a James Bond movie back in the, it was Sean Connery a little bit, the Roger Moore days, back in the Roger Moore days. I still remember going to a movie theater in England to watch a Roger Moore James Bond movie, and he was like, the height was completely disproportionate to the head, and it wasn't just because I was short. But I remember there would be a movie, and the whole country would shut down because everybody loved the James Bond movie. And the fact that they were playing, like, that's what you watched, right? It's, hey man, Friday nights, you know, it's the James Bond movie. And we'd sort of sit there, my family would sit there in the bed and watch it on our grainy 12-inch black and white TV with the ripples, the old cathode ray tube ripples. And it was great. It was a great time. But now, of course, you can scroll endlessly through five different media streaming platforms and still not find anything you want to see. It's because it could be something better. It could be something better. Or you try it for 3 minutes and don't give it much of a chance. But all right. T.S. See, we've gone from C.S. Lewis to T.S. Eliot. T.S., what is on your mind? Oh, he's come and gone. But I think that was an error on X's part. Hang on a sec. All right. I think you're on. Do you need to unmute? T.S., are you here? All right. Well, I'll just have to keep going because I'm not sure if he's having some technical issues or what. But yeah, options. you boot up YouTube and it's like in infinity. I never heard back from them, by the way. Had a pretty strong petition at Team YouTube on X. Never got a response from them about a yay or a nay, which is a shame. I think that they owe me a channel back. I think that the things that they believe about me are not true, and I've got tons of counter evidence for all of the things. Eugenics. Can you imagine me as a voluntarist wanting a completely peaceful and free society, talking about eugenics, the government programs designed to have people have children or have people not have children, forced sterilizations? I mean, it's pretty simple. Is it a violation of the non-aggression principle or not? Like, no matter what the problem is, the solution is more freedom. Once you get that basic principle, a couple of basic principles. You know, let's do a couple of basic principles. Because, you know, it's philosophy. A couple of basic principles are good. Two from economics, right? Are very, very important. All human desires are infinite. All resources are finite. It's a very sort of basic principle. Number one. Number two, there is no efficient way for resources to be created or transferred in society without the price system. You can't do it. No such thing as central planning. No such thing as the commissar of how much wheat you need in the next 5 years. There is only the price system. There is no other way to do it. The price system gives you an immediate amount of near infinite knowledge about supply and demand. The price system, like let's say the price of gold goes up a lot. Well, some people are going to start selling off grandma's jewelry that no central planner even knows really exists. And the beauty of the price system is, honestly, like, you know, you see those aerial drone shows from China where it's like an entire floating Chinese dragon going through the sky. That's nothing compared to the coordination and beauty of the price system. Ooh, amazing. I mean, just a simple example, right? Well, you're short of widgets, therefore the price of widgets goes up, therefore people have more incentive to produce widgets. Oh, there's too many widgets. Well, the price of widgets is going to go down. People are going to repurpose things to other uses. Oh, we've got cars. Okay, we don't need the horse and carriage so much. So people will shift their resources away from horse and carriages and towards cars. Beautiful. Honestly, if you get this incredible cosmic dance of incredibly nuanced, rippling, sparkly information shooting all over the place, simply because of a free market and the price system, it's absolutely beautiful. It is operatic. It is Van Gogh in terms of satisfying needs, wants, and desires. Amazing. The price system is one of the most glorious aspects of human society. And every time you mess with the price system, with subsidies, taxes, tariffs, paper requirements, licenses, like every time you mess with the price system, you just take a hammer blow to human wealth, productivity, and the satisfaction of wants. All resources are finite. All human desires are infinite. And there's no conceivably better way to have the spontaneous self-organization of society operate on a material basis than the free market and the price system. It's beautiful. It's absolutely glorious. Well, I will stop here. I really appreciate it. We just had a nice little cozy hour of chats. And I'm sorry for the people who wanted to talk. Some technical issues. I think X works pretty well. Yesterday, I started space twice and it didn't work. So I had to start it on the fly. But that's great. I mean, the fact that we can do this is pretty remarkable to me, because when I was last on X like a half a decade ago, this wasn't happening, my friends. So thanks everyone so much for a lovely chat. I look forward to your feedback as a whole. You can always email me, host@freedomain.com. That's host like the MC of a show rather than host as in the heavenly fleshly body of Christ manifest as a wafer. So host@freedomain.com. You can, of course, visit my site at freedomain.com and freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I will see you guys tomorrow night for a video live stream. Get to see my gorgeous speckled ostrich egg of a head looking way better than it did at 18. Just kidding. Have yourself a glorious afternoon, everyone. Lots of love from up here. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.